So this evening, I want to continue with the exploration of the four foundations of mindfulness, and I think this will be my last one. So at the end of our session, we should have complete mastery of the four foundations. But the main aim is to give some encouragement to work with this model. You know, that, as I think I mentioned last time, a lot of us, our meditation can feel helpful, but it can get sometimes stale and rote. We can just sit and meditate and feel vaguely calm. And that can be helpful. And we can feel vaguely calm, but there's often not a lot of clarity or precision in our meditation. And there also might not be that much learning. And so one of the reasons to work with one of these traditional models is to give some energy for our practice and help to give us, in a way, a little more clarity, precision, direction, and it can also really help in a wonderful way with developing more interest, curiosity, excitement, and more of a sense of inquiring, of really looking carefully, which is a wonderful quality of practice. It really makes things come alive, gives us a lot of energy, can lead us to really wanting to practice rather than how many of us have the sense of duty. I should do my 15 or 20 minutes today. Okay. Anyone occasionally have that motivation? Well, of course, there's something valuable there, but curiosity and interest and wanting to explore the nature of the mind can be a wonderful motivation. And that can be a fruit of working with these four foundations. So I'm going to primarily focus on the fourth foundation, the last one, and continue from what we explored last time and the recordings of last time and of the talks and explorations of the first three foundations are on the website, so you can use them as you see fit. I think some of them we forgot to do a recording of the guided practice today, I believe. Do you have that? Yeah, I didn't record it either. But we have recordings of some of the guided practices as well. So a brief review. First of all, we can start to see through these lenses, and it's interesting because there's also been a number of ways that mindfulness is being taught in the West, which don't necessarily work with the very traditional way of guiding mindfulness. And a lot of them can be quite useful. So we know one of the major ways of teaching mindfulness now is the method developed by Michelle McDonald called RAIN. Some of you know that. Recognize, acknowledge, inquire, and the last one's talked about differently, sometimes non-identification with what's happening, sometimes bring in a more of a heart quality, sometimes it's called, I think Tara Brach these days calls it nourishment, right? But it can be really helpful to use this traditional model. So in that model, the quality of mindfulness first of all, presupposes that we can really connect with whatever's happening in experience. And of course, very often we're distracted, so we can't easily do that. And so we often may be with the breath. And in fact, the first foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of the body. And that often is what we use to ground, to be present, to be able to stay with experience if we're distracted. And we'll see that the movement from the first through the fourth foundation is a way of going into greater subtlety, deepening, and complexity. And we often would start with the first foundation, just being with the body is awake, a lot of us with the breath. So with the one of the qualities of mindfulness is just to stay with what's there. Another quality is that mindfulness has is to know what's happening. Mindfulness is the knowing quality in terms of what is occurring. And we might work with this in different ways. We might have a mental label that says thinking or planning or one of our top five, you know. And this often our top five thoughts, and that would be more something that we develop in the third foundation, which is especially related to thoughts and emotions. Mindfulness is related very much to wisdom. The aim of continually being mindful is not simply to be mindful for its own sake, but to be able to see clearly what's happening, and then, especially as we develop in the fourth foundation, see some of the patterns of experience. I thought I'd read a nice summary of the nature of mindfulness from Christina Feldman, who's an English teacher. Mindfulness is not only a technique or practice, but it's concerned with the quality of watchful presence and the willingness to learn that we bring to each moment in our lives. It is saturated with sensitivity and curiosity, with the willingness to make peace with all moments and all things, and the deep wish to be free wherever we are. Mindfulness illuminates all things and all activities. We also know that mindfulness is present-centered. It's not so much focused, certainly initially, on the past or the future. It's really being with what is happening in the present moment. There's a quality of mindfulness which is also allowing. We let go of the very strong tendency in a lot of us to fix experience or manipulate it, right? And especially in the first three foundations, that is developed to a high degree. And so, as I mentioned last time, the first three foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feeling tone, which we also explore in the guided practice, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and then mindfulness of what in the original language is citta, which I typically translate as just thoughts and emotions. This is knowing thoughts and emotions. In the first three foundations, we come to know the constituents of experience, and the quality of mindfulness is much more receptive. We receive experience, we come to see it, we come to know it. The fourth foundation brings in the wisdom factor much more. And the fourth foundation, which I'll get to in a few moments, as we saw last time, sees experience through one of five different frameworks. And all those frameworks permit us to see experience more clearly. The fourth foundation brings in the wisdom factor, and it also brings in the factor of responding to what's happening. The first three are more passive in a way. They're just knowing what's going on. The fourth is we may do something about what's happening. We may respond, we may act in certain ways. And so that's a distinguishing mark. So again, the first foundation, mindfulness of the body, in the text it occurs in six different ways. In the West, generally, the instruction just works with the first three. Mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of the different postures of the body, and mindfulness during the activities of the body where we move, where we wash the dishes, take a walk, and so forth. And this is primarily where we explore mindfulness of the body. In the traditional model, there were three other types. One was where one contemplates a corpse. As I think I mentioned, this is not caught on in the Western traditions. We do not have corpses at Spirit Rock. But sometimes I know one teacher, Bob Stahl, who does a lot with mindfulness of the body, based in Santa Cruz, about once a year he takes interested people to to see an autopsy and to actually tune into the body at the level of a corpse, which can be quite powerful. You know, and I don't know, maybe you've done that at times with loved ones when they've died. Probably, how many of you have sat with dead bodies? Yeah. Could be horror, could be dead bodies of animals. I remember once I was living in the country and there was a poor sheep that got caught in the creek and the body was there for like a day or two. You could notice it. Another of the traditional ones is being mindful of the qualities of the body in terms of earth, air, fire, and water. It's a traditional way of contemplating, which helps when we do that. It's taught some, but not very much. When we do that, we have more of a sense of our body being just like the rest of nature and having these four qualities, which, you know, in the ancient metaphysics were understood as the basic qualities of all that exists. And seeing our own life in that way can lead us to really see more our bodies as being continuous with the rest of existence. And then the other one is called mindfulness of the 32 parts of the body. And again, Bob Stahl teaches that. Anyone interested could look up his teaching on Dharma Seed if you're interested. He teaches it typically in a retreat in the fall, but the recordings are there. The second foundation is a particularly important one. You know, you might think that mindfulness of the body, well, that's kind of seems to be an important one. The third foundation, which I'm interpreting as mindfulness of thoughts and emotions, well, that should be there, right? We don't want to forget about thoughts and emotions. The second one is mindfulness of the feeling tone, the sense of pleasant or neutral. And that might be like unexpected focus, right? But the reason it's so important is that, as we saw in the guided practice, awareness of the sense of pleasant helps us to see the tendencies when something is pleasant for us to want and then grasp. When it helps us to see when there's something unpleasant that will tend to push it away. And in fact, we can sometimes work with the second foundation backwards. We're having reactivity in the mind. Maybe something happened in an interpersonal relationship and I'm very reactive towards that other person. I can sometimes go back and say, let me feel there's something unpleasant in what happened, or maybe there's anger, right? And I can notice it. Oh, yeah, let me notice that unpleasant quality. We can sometimes work backwards in that way. And that can be really helpful. And this is, this particular foundation can give tremendous interest. You could study this for the next year. It would be really, really fruitful. You know, notice particularly when there's something pleasant or unpleasant. Because the teaching is, when we don't notice the pleasant, we grasp. When we don't notice the unpleasant, we push away. We don't notice the neutral, we space out. That is a summary of what are called the three poisons: greed, hatred, and delusion. So knowing the feeling tone is the key to uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion in the mind, and that is actually the entirety of the work of meditation. And so who would think that just paying attention to something pleasant would be helpful. And I've mentioned sometimes that, you know, in teaching this, and I had a group once, and I said, you know, the pleasant is not the problem. We could, next week, sit here and eat chocolate the entire evening and notice the pleasant quality. And this would be very, very useful time. And they said, let's try it. And so we did. We ate chocolate and we noticed. We noticed the pleasant. And we noticed how, after a while of eating chocolate, the degree of pleasure was diminished. Right? So it's impermanent, right? But the key is just to, so this is a great practice to do with meals or just being with anything that is wonderful, beautiful. And again, the pleasant isn't the issue. The grasping is a problem in the Buddhist understanding. The unpleasant also isn't a problem per se. It's the reactivity. Right? It's the reactivity of pushing away the unpleasant. And in fact, this particular teaching links very much with the Four Noble Truths, which is the last teaching of the entire series. Because when we can actually notice that reactivity developing in the two forms, from grabbing hold or pushing away, and we actually can not go there, this is actually starting to free up our experience. Because really, the Fourth Noble Truth is about ending reactivity. It's being with the whole range of experience, increasingly, without reactivity. From a positive point of view, that would be called being with each moment of experience with freedom. That is the core intention of all of what we're doing. It's to be free. And we, you know, the beauty of this practice is that we learn freedom moment by moment. And we develop freedom moment by moment. And we do it in this protected space of meditation. And then we can bring it out into more complex forms of life. Right? Such as relating to other people. Talking. Having a job. Thinking about the elections in 2020, the higher level of complexity. I went to a party just this afternoon of a friend's birthday party, and I met someone who was developing a project to use a database that could be applied to every voting station to determine whether there is voter fraud. Really promising. We're talking strategically. Who should you talk to first? Anyway, but to bring what we learn in this simplified meditation into all the parts of our life, that's the great work, right? We can sometimes be very peaceful, calm in meditation or in a retreat, but hopefully all of us have good challenges in daily life. Anyone not have enough challenges? Very good. So the second foundation, crucial, and again, it would be valuable just to focus on that for a year or for a month, you know, and remember it every morning. You know, you can practice it like we practiced it here, focusing on when the sense of pleasant or unpleasant is somewhat strong. You can also just notice moment to moment, usually just do it for a minute or two or three, that every moment has a sense of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And this was we worked with this principle when I went through once a psychotherapy training, and we actually had us each sit and watch each person come before us and notice whether the feeling tone was pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral with each person. Because this was important for what's called in psychotherapy counter-transference, right, where you really want to know what your own reaction is to the person. And I've sometimes done this in meditation retreats where I've sat looking at everyone as they come into the dining hall and trying to sense pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Mm. You know, just one person after another. Pleasant. Very pleasant. Unpleasant. Neutral. Very unpleasant. Right? So you can do this Vedana practice in public spaces. Or you go to a party. Okay. So the third foundation is the I interpret it mindfulness of thoughts and emotions, and in some ways it's pretty straightforward. Here's that we're really knowing what's going on, and again, very familiar to most of us. We can use a label and say planning, remembering. We want to see often what the top five repetitive thoughts are in our mind, give those a label. We want to see those clearly before we get caught up in them. And so this is, for many of us, this is right at the center of much of our daily practice, right? It's tracking thoughts, tracking emotions. And again, we use different tools, particularly when emotions are there. We can also feel the emotions in the body, notice the storyline with emotions. This would be called a form of inquiry. Notice what's there. What's something, an emotion, kind of a complex, maybe a difficult interaction with someone, a complex of thoughts and emotions stays for 3 minutes, and we look at it. What's it like in the body? What's the narrative? We looked at that in, the discussion afterwards, right? What do you do with a really strong, repetitive thought, right? Good strategy, be with the body, change the channel. It's a good way to get out of being locked into a view or a repetitive thought. So, and then the fourth foundation, which I'll talk about the rest of the time, goes to another level. Last time I gave a quote from the Venerable Analeo, who mentioned how the fourth foundation really takes us through five different frameworks, all the way, we could say, to liberation. It's one way of interpreting it, because there are five frameworks. And here in the fourth foundation, as I mentioned earlier, we're bringing wisdom more explicitly in by seeing experience through, we might say, the lens of a particular framework. And in the text, there are five frameworks given. Now we look at the first framework is the framework of the so-called hindrances. And think, as you hear these, you can see that there's a kind of developmental sequence. We start by seeing what gets in the way of being present, the so-called hindrances. And we looked at those in some depth last time. The so-called hindrances, another translation is the difficult energies, that which makes it hard to be present. And those, though, you know, many of you are familiar with that model, it's named as the mind either being reactive by wanting and grasping, on number one, being aversive, pushing away, number two. When those are strong, can't really be present very much. Number three, what's usually translated as sloth and torpor, you know, which being sleepy, low energy, whatever language we want to use. I think sloth and torpor is part of our heritage of wonderful Victorian translations that use words that are never used in the United States. Sloth and torpor. But I think the terms now have a following. Many people would be disappointed if I didn't mention those terms. Probably. Anyway. Third, that's the third. And the fourth is kind of the opposite. It's when there's too much energy. Restlessness. It can be from too much body energy, a lot of energy in the body, or it can be just from being restless because the mind is overly active or the emotions are very driven in some way. And then the fifth is doubt. Really doubt whether I have the capacity to be mindful, or doubt about a teacher or teachings, whatever. And so this first framework, when we work through it, you can see that it actually helps to make possible, when we've worked with the hindrances skillfully, it makes possible further practice. And we can go forward. The second, and last time we looked at a little bit of depth at how to work with each of those five difficult energies. And so, the full treatment of that first framework would involve being mindful of the difficult energies, seeing what they're about. Very interesting, many of you probably have experienced, you can actually be mindful of being sleepy. It's a very interesting practice, right? You can be mindful of all these, and sometimes the mindfulness is just like 10 or 20%, but you actually can be mindful of being sleepy, and probably people have experienced this maybe on retreats a little bit more. It's really, really interesting because one can be mindful of being sleepy, and sometimes when that happens, the sleepiness goes away, and suddenly you notice yourself, you've just been kind of a little bit hazily being mindful of sleepiness, and all of a sudden, the day is bright. And there you are. So the next of the frameworks is one that I gave the guided meditation on, and that is the framework of the aggregates, which is also translated, it's a translation of the word skanda. The literal meaning is heaps. And what this really is, this is the way that the Buddha talked about the constituents of experience without talking about a self. So this is one of the ways that the Buddha gets at the experience of not-self, or the way he pointed to what we might call the selfless quality of experience. And so it's an unpacking of anatta. I've taught on that here, and when I teach briefly, I do a different approach where I say one way to work with, this is my own approach, not traditional, that one way to really explore the sense of the selfless quality of experience when we look closely is to see where there's a sense of a thick self. Could be like self-image, self-consciousness, someplace I'm wounded or have a lot of charge. And then study that, look at that carefully. And then on the other hand, do practices which help to develop a more thinned out sense of self. And mindfulness of the aggregates fits in that second group. So it's the main way that the Buddha gave to understand that sense of the selfless quality of experience when we look carefully. Even the selfless quality of the self. So I'll say a little bit about each of these, and we explored them in the meditation. So the and you can start to see really how this fourth foundation brings in the wisdom dimension. Earlier, we were just being with the constituents of experience, but here in the fourth foundation, it says, look through this lens, and you'll come to a certain kind of wisdom. Look at experience, and instead of thinking, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm meditating, use the framework of looking for bodily experience in a very simple way. Just could be the experience of body sensations, could be the experience of sound, taste, and so forth. Just the various experiences of the body. And if we were working with this way of exploring the fourth foundation, we could do very much like what we did in the guided meditation. We would say, okay, let me tune into the body. So the training would have really two parts. The first would be taking them one at a time, getting the experience of just being with the bodily experience. Secondly, just being with the feeling tone, sense of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. We would do them separately at first to get familiar with them. Thirdly, being with what is usually translated as perception. It's not the greatest translation. The word in the original language is sana. And it's really the sense of there being some kind of association, almost like a mental association with something, but you can have that with thoughts as well. You can recognize, oh, there's that thought. So it's not just perception we usually think of coming through the various senses, right? But in the Buddhist framework, it really is any kind of association or recognition based on memory. And so we notice when that occurs, when we have some experience and there's an association. And again, most helpful to really to work with each of these for a period of time. Then the fourth, similar to the third foundation, is just noticing thoughts and emotions. And the fifth is noticing consciousness. It's also a constituent experience. And we can just tune in, oh, yes, there's awareness. That's what I'm noticing. Then we can bring them together, all five, and we can, as it were, just be with the flow of experience and notice what's happening. And we can do so, the teaching is, without a sense of self. Okay, what is there? Oh, and the teaching is that there's just going to be one of these five. That's it. There's not, you know, any sense of self might be reducible to being like an association or a thought and emotion. And a lot of the teaching is that the sense of self is a thought, which we can notice. So we would work with this in that way. We would, I think, develop a capacity to be with each of those individually, and then we'd bring them together. And in many ways, this isn't so different from what our ordinary practice is. But the sense is that we want to just get with the flow of one experience after the other. Notice when the sense of self comes in. This can connect with my teaching about a thick self. Just be with the flow of experience and notice when a sense of self arises. And you can study that. And again, the teaching is, it's going to, you know, is the sense of self more like a thought, a memory? Right? So ultimately, one can just be with that flow of experience. And of course, that being with this teaching is a little more complex. I'd want to say a lot more to really bring out the different nuances, but that's the basic way of being mindful through the five aggregates. I think, again, if we're doing it in a practical way, work with them each separately, like we did in the guided meditation, and when you have some capacity, then bring it together and see if you can just be with the flow of experience, one thing after another, and then notice what makes that hard. Or gets in the way. So again, this is pointing to the wisdom quality. You know, to some extent, I think these the five aggregates, or even these five different frameworks, are a little, in my mind, a little bit arbitrary. We could also focus, let's say, on impermanence. It's not one of the five. Not one of the five frameworks. You know, we could do that if we. Yeah, and so, but it really gives a lens by which to develop the wisdom quality, because in the traditional sense of wisdom from the tradition, we have wisdom about impermanence, things changing, which comes out very clearly when you just stay with the aggregates, one thing after another, things changing. The second aspect of wisdom is seeing the nature of dukkha, or suffering, or reactivity, which comes out, I think, looking at the feeling tone, also comes out in the last of the frameworks, the four foundations of mindfulness. And thank you for staying with and tracking all these different frameworks.
Okay.
I realize it's okay. Where did that framework go? Okay, a lot of frameworks. But what's interesting is that this gives a kind of sequence, that when you work with these in sequence, and again, maybe one could do that as a group over a few months, it goes from the more gross to the more subtle. It goes from working with the hindrances to the aggregates. Then it goes to, you know, in a way related, goes to the what are called the sense spheres, the different senses. Then it starts moving towards awakening. Then the fourth framework that one's instructed to look through, I should say, are the factors of awakening, where increasingly the qualities of an awakened mind are present and developed. Qualities like mindfulness, like energy, like inquiry, interest, tranquility, calm, concentration, equanimity. And then the last framework is the framework of the Four Noble Truths. And as I mentioned last time, when I teach this fourth foundation in a short time, which is usually what I do when I teach in a group or retreat, I don't go into as much detail as we're going into here, and I give the example of you can apply and use the Four Noble Truths as a framework for your meditation. Four Noble Truths are, there is dukkha, I like to translate it as reactivity, usually translated as suffering, but suffering in the sense of being different from simply the unpleasant. It's more the pushing away, the reaction to something unpleasant, that's suffering. Suffering isn't synonymous with pain or the unpleasant. Important point. And so, the second noble truth being that there's some kind of grasping or pushing away. In a way, it's the way I define dukkha. It's kind of almost like synonymous. And then the third noble truth is that it's possible not to be reactive, not to suffer. Peace is possible. Balance is possible. And the fourth noble truth are the, you know, practical guidelines for getting there. And so we could apply this four noble truths model very, very simply in experience by in this way. Be on the lookout for any moment of reactivity. If it occurs, be mindful of it. What's it feel like in the mind or body? And suppose you, again, had a difficult interaction with someone 2 days ago, and you noticed yourself blaming and judging this person. I noticed that in my formal meditation or during the day. I noticed that. Oh, reactivity. Okay. Let me be with it. Feel what it's like. What's it like in the body? What's my narrative? Stay with it. Explore it. That's for number one. Number two, is there some kind of grasping or pushing away? And the answer always comes back very quickly, yes. And you try to notice it or tune into it, right? Okay, is there a way that I'm really pushing away what happened in this interaction? Yeah, I didn't like what this person said. It really kind of triggered me, right? And so you feel, yeah, really, you can feel that quality of pushing away, the reactivity. And then thirdly, you ask, is it possible to let go of that reactivity? And you may get an answer very quickly back, no. I'm right. That person's wrong. Forget the third noble truth. I'm staying with my vengeance. That may be where you go. Okay. But we could also, and again, if we were actually going into this in some depth, it can be more complicated than this. Sometimes we don't simply let go of difficult feelings and so forth, but we might have the vision that that's possible. We may say, I'd like to let go of this, but I think I need to feel the anger a little bit more. You know, practically speaking, I don't think it's always so skillful just to notice something and just say, okay, let go of it. Sometimes it can be valuable to sit with it to kind of work through, because just the idea of letting go often isn't going to work that well. But it's pointing. We might point to, is there a way I can let go? And then we can use the fourth noble truth, the Noble Eightfold Path, which gives a lot of methods. And we might say, yeah, I want to let go of this, but I think I need to sit with it some. Maybe I need to do forgiveness practice. Maybe I need to do that. So we may, it may not be simply a matter, sometimes it can be a matter of simply letting go, right? Or I might be getting irritated at a meeting that my preferred outcome is not occurring. And I just notice myself being reactive. I do the first and second noble truth, and then I come to the third and I say, yeah, okay, I see that my outcome is not happening, and I can understand that. I think I'm just going to let go and be with the meeting as it is. So some situations we could really just let go, go to the third noble truth right away. Some of them we might say, I want to let go skillfully by staying with this a little more, feeling my anger, maybe doing some forgiveness, some compassion practice, and so forth. That would be a way of using our tools and resources to move towards that quality of peace. So that could be, that's a very concrete way of working with the fourth foundation, probably the one that I use most and that I teach most, using the Four Noble Truths in a very simple way. Identifying the suffering or reactivity, staying with it, noticing if there's the grasping or pushing away, feeling that, trying to get a sense of what might lead to peace. And then implementing it. So let me end here. And again, my hope is that some of this can inspire you to work with one of these models. And again, you know, over time, working with several of them could be really, really helpful. There's really these traditional teachings are not so often done. And even I've noticed certain number of people even, probably the majority of people are not even aware in depth of the teachings of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, even though these are the core teachings about mindfulness in the tradition. It's interesting, right? But now you have them, and as the Buddha used to say, use them as you see fit. Okay, thank you. So we have some time for any questions. Maybe let me just invite us to, before we go into discussion, just to sit for a moment and ask yourself what may have been valuable from exploring through the talk and through your own reflections and through the meditation. What's valuable about the teachings? Is there something that I want to implement myself, maybe in the next week? Again, what was helpful, interesting? And I'll invite now also any reflections or questions of any kind that's come up in relation to any of the four foundations, but particularly the fourth. We can use the microphone. Up front, to my right, and then in the back. Yeah. Hi.
Thanks. Yeah, this is great. Thanks. I appreciated the thick self versus thin self. Aggregates, and I found these teachings to be helpful in our practice. My question is, what does it mean to cause harm in the context of these teachings, and specifically? specifically I'm asking for forgiveness practice, I'm finding myself coming up empty, because it sort of given brings someone to mind that has caused me harm, and I just find myself saying, what does that mean? What does that mean? What does it mean for someone to cause me harm in the context of earth, air, fire, water, not self, impermanence?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you have ideas on how to form that mentally.
Yeah. So what does causing harm mean in the context of not self? And how might we work with it? Generally speaking, I think we have to be careful somewhat using a concept like harm. And this comes up in a lot in teaching forgiveness, and I think I probably have taught that here a little bit. And some of you know that some of the traditional forgiveness phrases have lines like, if I have hurt you in word, thought, or deed, may I be forgiven. And I think that causality is more complicated. Obviously, we can hurt someone physically very directly. But when we hurt someone, so to speak, in ways that are more mental or emotional, it's more complicated. Because I don't think we actually have the capacity to cause other people's emotions. We can trigger them. But I think I would distinguish between triggering and causing. So that's, I don't know if that's where you were going, but that's one, for me, important distinction that we can, but I found in trying to rephrase the forgiveness lines that it got too clunky to say, if I have spoken in a way which may have triggered you such that you had difficult experiences. In reality, I think that's what happens. You know, and triggering is a metaphor as well. And I think it's a little more accurate to the experience, you know, that one example that we could give that would bring this out was, let's suppose that I have an agreement to meet with my friend at 9:30 in the morning for a meeting, okay? My friend doesn't come at 9:30. What might be my emotions? I might be angry and frustrated. Maybe this has happened many times, and I jump to conclusions, oh, it's irresponsible Stephen, or whatever. But I also might be concerned. I might be worried. I might also really appreciate, I've been really busy. Oh, I had a free half hour. Wonderful. Right? So, did that person cause harm for me? Well, we might say that, you know, you hurt me by not coming on time, but what I'm actually experiencing can depend on a lot of factors. And we can look at a lot of experiences as like that, right? And so, and yet, of course, certain things would tend to trigger things in a lot of people, right? Be it calling people nasty names would trigger a lot of people, but not everyone, right? Depends on the context, right? And so for that reason, I'm hesitant to talk about causing harm if it's not physical, right? And that it really, because there are more complex factors involved. And so nonetheless, we can act unskillfully all the time. And so it is valuable to do forgiveness practice. But it comes down especially to my own intention. Or if that person coming late triggered my anger, I could do forgiveness practice in relation to my anger, simply without without thinking that, you know, this person was simply bad, or even I could do it before I even know what happened, right? Because I got angry. And then the other piece of your question, I think, is that okay, this is where I was saying that talking about anatta or not self fairly briefly leaves out a lot of nuances and complexities. And generally speaking, as you know, may remember from the way I've worked here, I tend to have a developmental framework for understanding the relation between self and not self. And there are many, many contexts where it's skillful actually use a concept of self. And you find this with the Buddha. You find a lot of contexts, particularly ethical, where a sense of self is important for accountability, responsibility. And so I like the kind of approach that says a sense of self is very valuable at certain stages of practice and for certain kinds of practices. It's not ultimate. And at a certain point, one goes beyond it. That's what the particular training that we explored is about. But it's not the way of seeing all parts of our experience that's most skillful. For being ethical, keeping agreements, even keeping up with your meditation practice, it can really be helpful to have a sense of self. The problem is that we then learn later not to take it as ultimate. So does that get at it? So, thanks. Yeah. We have then on the side. Yeah, sorry, thanks for the question. Sorry, it was a bit of a long answer, but it's a complicated question.
Okay. Thank you, Donald.
Yeah.
I was interested in when you read last week the Analyo bit about the progression or the flow through these four, the five frameworks. I'd like to learn more about that. Where do I find that?
Quote is from his book on Satipatthana, pages 184 and 185. Okay, that's his book called Satipatthana,
the direct path
to realization. Right? Okay, and so the idea is that when you look at these frameworks, they point towards awakening. Right? You start by clearing out what gets in the way, the hindrances. And you go through learning to see not self, and you come to see just things moving, the senses, the body, all this is like a dance of forces. And then you see where you're caught or stuck, and you learn how to become free. So that's the direction, the way that all these teachings, you kind of, the first three foundations, you develop the capacities to be mindful, mindfulness of the core constituents of experience, and then you bring in more complexity to move towards freedom. That's full, isn't it? Yeah. And please. You were next, I think. We have time maybe, if these are brief, we have time for two. Not brief, just time for one more. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
For this evening. I guess, more of a comment, I'm not sure yet, but one way that what you said this evening was really helpful for me is being aware of reactivity, which I like to think more often than not I can catch it and I'll be reactive and then I'll calm and I can see better.
Yeah,
so within the last week I had an experience where I could see and feel just how, let me think, how do I say it, how many situations I'm grieving and feel the my sadness, you know, and there's a lot.
Yeah.
And I ran like hell. I just reacted. And it was so painful. And I think now this evening that I then reacted to my reactivity and got caught in old behavior, which is very punitive, self-punitive, and holy moroni. It was just really hard and so painful. So it's helpful, because usually I can catch myself being reactive and just seeing it, you know, has an effect. And then now I feel like when I'm just unbelievably reactive, stay with it. Because I kept trying to find a way out, think it, or whatever, you know, none of which was helpful. But to stay with the reactivity, I kept trying to get back to the feelings, and it's the reactivity that was, would have been, was this evening,
thanks,
you know, helpful.
Yeah.
And I'd like to say one thing about sloth and torpor. About sloth and torpor.
I'm not hearing.
Sloth and torpor.
Oh, sloth and torpor.
And torpor.
Okay. We're going to need to be a little brief in terms of the time. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Well, shall I stop?
What?
I can stop.
Okay. Maybe we can talk after we finish more if you'd like. Yeah. But thank you for that. Sometimes noticing of reactivity calms the reactivity. Sometimes, and then you can notice reactivity towards reactivity. That's another great observation, right? And can really notice that. And the only other piece I would add is that sometimes when there's a lot of reactivity, it can be helpful to bring in the heart practices, hold it with compassion, and so forth. Yeah.